The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning, I want to do something a little different for what I usually do, and that is to introduce you to my new book. So it was released last week, and it's a book that I've worked on for probably over 20 years, one way or the other. It wasn't meant to be a book originally. I just took an interest in particular teachings that are attributed to the Buddha and found them very intriguing. And in the process of being intrigued, started looking at the original language text and started translating it. And then periodically I'd pick it up and do a little bit more. And sometimes, I think probably it was 10 years went by where I didn't do anything, probably. But picked it up here and there. And eventually decided to put it together as a book, and that just was released last week. It involves a translation of a book that in English the title translates as the Book of Eights, and not a particularly intriguing title or inspiring title. And some people are all too familiar with how Buddhism has all these lists, so the Book of Eights. Seems like it's in that category. However, the title that's usually translated as the Book of Eights is a little bit ambivalent, ambiguous, what it actually means, because the word that is pronounced is the Pali word for eight. The same pronunciation also means meaning or benefit or goal. So it's the Book of the Goal or the Book of the Highest Meaning or something like that. And that maybe gives it a little bit more rich feeling for it. And I was first introduced to this Book of Eights almost 30 years ago, when I was still kind of doing my Zen practice. And it was introduced to me as offering the same kind of radical teachings as you find in Zen. So that kind of got my interest. Same kind of radical teachings as some of you know, the kind of Mahayana philosophy called Madhyamaka, sometimes called the Proto-Madhyamaka text. And in fact, it has a very radical teaching in the text. Very different orientation or different perspective on Buddhism than how we usually learn about it. And so to add to the intrigue of this text is that many scholars believe it's the earliest teachings of the Buddha has very primitive, not primitive, but very kind of archaic language, a kind of language that predates the rest of the canon. It has ideas that are simpler. It lacks a lot of the numerical lists, even though the book is called the Book of Eights. The reason why it's called Book of Eights, if that's why, is that four of the poems in the book have eight verses. So rather than a numerical list of one more set of teaching, it's a poetic text. And some of the poems have these eight verses. And it doesn't refer to any settled monasticism that we know of. So people think that perhaps it comes from the time when the Buddha was a wandering teacher, before the formation of his Buddhist order and before people were settled in monasteries. And so one idea is that it's teachings that stem from the earliest period of his teaching. And a lot of the things that, if you go into a kind of common textbook that's going to introduce you to Buddhism, you probably get teachings like the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Paths. They might teach a little bit about what's called the three characteristics, about how emphasis on impermanence, suffering, and particularly not self. And the people get intrigued or perplexed about this Buddhist teachings of not self. You might read about the four foundations of mindfulness. You might read about the four jhanas, states of concentration. You might read about the 12 links of dependent origination. You might read about the conditioned and unconditioned reality, the conditioned world that we live in, and somehow this transcendent, unconditioned plane of existence that some Buddhists will posit. all those teachings are absent in this Book of Eights. And the question is why? Why is it absent? And one theory is that this represents teachings that arose before this systematizing of Buddhism, before it was kind of constructed into this bigger system of numbers and lists and started to make reflections about the nature of reality. And I'm kind of inclined to view it that way. I certainly find the text very inspiring, though it's really hard to know for sure where the source of this text is, and exactly, you know, is it even from the Buddha? You know, we can't be 100% sure. Is it really his earliest teachings? We can't really be sure. But I think the preponderance of evidence strongly suggests that this is really a very early set of teachings. And one thing that suggests why it's early is that in the early Buddhist canon, it refers back to this text. And it doesn't just refer back to it in passing, but refers to this text as a text that the early Buddhists, at the time of the Buddha, were expected to memorize, were expected to recite and chant, and were expected to teach from, you know, as a teaching text, to use it as, you know. And it's very hard to know what are the most important teachings of the Buddha, because it's so voluminous, the number of teachings we have. And so what happens in different eras of here in the West, people pick different teachings as they think is the central important teachings, partly based on Western preferences. But one of the interesting ways of looking at what might be the earliest or most important teachings of this early tradition is you want to see what are those people back then, what did they emphasize? What did they think was important? And the things that they talked about, that you should memorize this, you should chant this, you should teach from this, that means that they thought it was important enough. And there's a set of teachings, different, and they're all poems, but a set of poems different from different sources that have this kind of pedigree of being something they memorized, chanted, and taught from. And what stands out about these sets of poems is they all have similar teachings to the Book of Eight. And so rather than thinking this book is an outlier or somehow unusual, my argument is that it actually represents the seed teachings out of which Buddhism arose. And a lot of what's in here doesn't contradict the many of the systematized forms of Buddhism. It contradicts maybe some of it, but it doesn't contradict much of it. But you can kind of see kind of like everything that arose after in the centuries after were an expansion from this seed, this source. But if you go back to this early text to see what it actually says, it gives you a very different perspective of how to relate to the different teachings, the later teachings. And this idea of how we relate to religious teachings is one of the important themes of this book. So I'll read something. So the Book of Eights gives the impression of containing the seeds that grew into the fully developed early Buddhist teachings in India. What may be perplexing to many is that the Book of Eights does not espouse a religious doctrine that exists in opposition to other doctrines, nor does it put forth a teaching that is meant to be seen as superior to other teachings. In a manner that challenges the religious beliefs of many people, including many Buddhists, the text explicitly denies the role of ultimate religious truth and knowledge in attaining personal peace. That's pretty radical. You can go home now if you want. In a manner that challenges the religious beliefs of many people, including many Buddhists, the text explicitly denies the role of ultimate religious truth and religious knowledge in attaining personal peace. So people who depend on Buddhist teachings, as they're going to tell them what the truth is, what the ultimate truth is, are going to be frustrated by this text. because it says, don't do that. Don't hold something up as being ultimate, as the greatest truth. But it's a little bit hard then, you know, when your neighbors go around and championing their religion as being ultimate, and you say, well, I don't have any ultimate teaching. And they say, they feel kind of sorry for you. that's unfortunate. And, you know, and we have this great, you know, great set of teachings, and it comes from great sources, and, you know, and there's all this hyperbole, there's wonderful ways of talking about it that makes it all flowery and wonderful, and they use great adjectives for it that just makes you kind of, you know, think that it's, you know, gives it a lot of authority and power. And then you say, well, we don't have any ultimate teachings. Then the question is, oh, what do you have? What do you have? And and this sentence that I just read, it ends with what we have, hopefully, what we can have, personal peace, attaining personal peace. And this is the emphasis of this text, is the emphasis is not on teachings, as or not on ultimate reality, and it's also not about attaining some ultimate meditation states. There's also not even any emphasis on attaining some kind of transcendent state of experience, like what we would sometimes call Nibbana. But rather, it focuses on attaining peace. And the question is, what is it that brings about this peace? And here also we find a kind of a radical message. Maybe it doesn't, the teachings don't work for everyone. Maybe they need to be contextualized, or people need to be prepared for it. But the teaching is very direct. If you want to have peace, be peaceful. If you want to be the ideal, and the text does have an ideal kind of goal of how a person can be, then behave like the ideal. And in doing so, it doesn't set up a series of techniques or practices you do in order to attain something. And that's also very different than how teachings are often taught, and even how I teach. But rather, the focus is kind of unrelentingly on just live differently. But the most important way it teaches is to be peaceful. There's a little quote from that I like from the text, a little slogan, it could be a bumper sticker. Release is peace. Release is peace. And the release is the release of clinging. And the primary practice is to release the clinging, the craving, the holding that we have. But it's not like a technique of how to do that. You do it by doing it. You do it to the degree which you can. That's what this text does over and over again. It's about letting go. It emphasizes letting go, letting go, letting go. And so it explicitly does not rely on many of the things that religious people rely on. So it certainly doesn't rely on ultimate religious teachings, the teachings on the truth. It also doesn't rely on what we normally would think of as religious practices. It doesn't rely on ethics, on virtue and precepts. There's a whole series of things that, you know, we usually rely on that this text doesn't hold up and champion as being important. It doesn't deny the value of those. I think I'm pretty confident it doesn't expect that you can attain this goal by being unethical. But it just continually points to the possibility of letting go, not craving, here and now. And the goal is very imminent. The goal of this text is completely about this life right here. It's not about some goal in the future or in future lifetimes, and it doesn't posit the goal of Buddhism in the context of rebirth. And as Buddhism developed in India, and even in the Buddhist canon, there became more and more emphasis on rebirth as being the context for the teachings and for the practice. In fact, some later Buddhist teachings are completely predicated on the idea of rebirth. there's really the foundation of them, and those religions, those Buddhist religious views, would just kind of crumble and fall apart if the belief in rebirth wasn't part of it. But here, in this early teaching, it's not predicated on rebirth whatsoever. In fact, repeatedly the text says that the ideal person, people who are interested in this peace, in this release, that is peace, would not bother to be interested in rebirth, future lives, becoming again or not becoming. That simply wouldn't be of interest. And in fact, nowhere in the book does the Buddha posit anything to do about claiming there's rebirth or multiple lives. He does talk about other people who have those beliefs, and he basically says that's foolish or that's not uninteresting to be involved in that, those kinds of thoughts. You could argue that it doesn't deny the existence of rebirth and multiple lives. It's just that if you want to be free, you don't focus on that. You don't think about it. And so all these things that people often rely on in Buddhism, and some people hold on to them very tightly, this book, in a certain way, in my mind, pulls the rug from underneath and leaves us kind of, you know, without it. And in this idea that not holding up something as being the ultimate truth, the book is says explicitly that a person who focuses on peace does not hold up anything as being the truth, like there's one truth. And that's kind of difficult for religious people. You know what? So the goal can be said to be psychological or therapeutic, in that what we're looking for, what the text is looking for, is how to live a life of peace. The way this gets emphasized in the text that is kind of interesting is that because it's a very early text, the contrast, the religious contrast, is with the Brahmanical religions of the time. And the Brahmins, kind of a high caste priests of that time, they focused on that religion, and they focused a lot on purity, attaining purity. And in this text, the Buddha, if you look at it really carefully, you see that both discussions about purity and discussions about peace, and the discussion of purity is always about what those other people are interested in, the Brahmins. The Buddha doesn't pick up purity as something that he's championing. He also doesn't, but he does champion peace. And so there's a kind of divide between some kind of, I don't know what to call it, but one of the differences is that the idea of purity tends to divide the world into pure and impure. The idea of peace doesn't have to do that. You're just peaceful, and you're there, and you're not separating out the world between what's acceptable and not acceptable in that way. So, before I read some poems from this translation itself, I said that in this early tradition, there's evidence of instructions to memorize, chant, and teach from particular sets of poems. And I said those sets of poems have similar teachings, that they lack a lot of the metaphysical, a lot of the systematization. They all emphasize kind of something you can attain here and now. And I want to read one of these poems. It's called An Auspicious Day. It appears 9 different times in this early collection of texts. So 9 times means it was probably pretty important for them. And it goes this way. Don't chase the past. Don't long for the future. The past is left behind. The future is not yet reached. Having insight into whatever phenomena are present, right where it is, have insight into whatever phenomena are present right where it is, not faltering and not agitated. By knowing whatever is present, one develops the mind. Ardently do what should be done today. Who knows? Death may come tomorrow. There is no bargaining with mortality and his great army. Whoever dwells thus ardent, active day and night, is, says the peaceful sage, one who has an auspicious day. So it's all about, you're going to die and show up here and practice here. This is in this life, right here in this phenomena. Have insight into your experience right now. And doing so, you become a peaceful sage. In this book, maybe because it's so early, the Buddha is not held up in some highly transcendental way, or he's not held up in some high pedestal that he came to hold later, and he's only once called the Buddha, even, and he's not called the Blessed One. He's not called all these the Thus Come One, the Tathagata. He's not kind of described in these great superhuman ways that he's described in later texts. He just appears like a simple person, ordinary person who's going around practicing. It's a very human-centered presentation, human-centered kind of religious life, with no emphasis on rebirth, no emphasis on other realms of gods and hells, no emphasis on superhuman powers. It's just, being here. Some people are critical of this kind of emphasis that modern people have on Buddhism because they feel we're denaturing or demythologizing Buddhism, or we're kind of making Buddha into a good Victorian humanist. But this text itself kind of suggests something that's very humanistic, very basic, very kind of ordinary. It's interesting that the way that a sage, the ideal person, is called a sage, and with a variety of different words, is referred to as someone who's wise. And so it's qualities of the person that are emphasized: peaceful, wise, equanimous. There's nothing about becoming the four stages of enlightenment: stream enter, once returner, non-returner, and arhat. The once-returner and non-returner refer to rebirth. Once-returner means you're going to be reborn one more time. Non-returner means you're never going to be reborn. But still, the person is being described from the point of view of rebirth. This does not appear in this early text at all. And the arhat, which is the fully enlightened person, the word arhat literally means someone who's worthy. Someone is worthy of respect, worthy of offerings. It's a social word. It establishes a relationship that you can have with people. There's nothing like that in this text. The sage is defined in personal terms for herself. Wise, understanding, they see, they know, they're peaceful, they're equanimous. That's the emphasis over and over again. So the question is, what do they know? If there's not going to be any religious truth, the ultimate truth that you know, ultimate reality you know, what do they know? Because the text does emphasize a lot the importance of knowing. Knowing and seeing. A sage knows and sees. So what do they know and see? What they know and see is how people get caught. What they know and see is what happens when people crave, when they hold on. What they know and see is how people get in trouble with their minds, with how they live their lives. A wise person knows how we get in trouble. And because of that, they know how to let go. A wise person doesn't know about ultimate reality. That wise person doesn't know some special privileged insight into the nature of truth or reality that no one else has. That's quite something. Many spiritual teachers are given authority by others because people assume they know something no one else knows. They see something. They have some access to some transcendent states of existence or states of attainment or something. And here, there's nothing like this whatsoever. But there is emphasis on a radical peace. And is a radical peace good enough? Is that good enough? Or, you know, well, that's not really, you know, do it. This text, a lot of these poems, there are 16 sets of poems in this translation, this work. And some of them were clearly written in the context of the debate culture of the time. Religious people back then, teachers, that were involved in very intense debates. And the consequences of losing these debates were dire. Because if you lost a debate, you had to become the student of the person you lost to. rather than teaching a doctrine that can be debated, the Buddha here teaches the importance of not clinging to concepts. In other words, he's not interested in doctrines as much as how people relate to them. Freedom isn't found through doctrines, though it does require not clinging to them. So you can't cling to doctrines and attain peace. There's a beautiful poem in here where the Buddha says, if you come to debate with me, there's no one here to debate with. There's no one here to quarrel with. You won't find anyone here. In focusing on cultivating behaviors and virtues, the Book of Eights rarely mentions the specific techniques or practices. Stated differently, the text doesn't emphasize religious practices that can be seen as steps towards attaining the qualities of the ideal person. Furthermore, it explicitly and provocatively says that religious observances and practices in themselves are not adequate for becoming a person at peace. Rather, it encourages people to simply behave like an ideal sage. One of the interesting poems in this text is held up to be an account of the Buddha talking about his distress before he became enlightened. And so it's kind of it's meant to be autobiographical. And so it's very humanistic. It's very kind of, you get a sense of the person who's in anguish or in distress or dismayed, and that's motivating him perhaps to engage in his spiritual quest. And here it is. Violence gives birth to fear. Just look at people and their quarrels. I will speak of my dismay and the way that I was shaken. Seeing people thrashing about like fish in little water, and seeing them feuding with each other, I became afraid. For the Buddha to say, I became afraid, even before he was enlightened, was kind of unacceptable in later Buddhism. When the Buddha became this lofty, superhuman kind of person, even before he was enlightened, he was supposed to kind of have all these wonderful powers and abilities. And you couldn't really allow your religious founder to have any faults. And to be afraid is one of them. And but here, in this wonderful text, also why I think it's humanistic, very early, before the later editors got onto it, and they wanted to kind of build up the religious founder to be this great being. Seeing people thrashing about like fish in little water, and seeing them feuding with each other, I became afraid. The world is completely without a core. Everywhere, things are changing. Wanting a place of my own, I saw nothing not already taken. I felt discontent at seeing only conflict to the very end. But then, I saw an arrow here, hard to see, embedded in the heart. Pierced by this arrow, people dash about in all directions. When the arrow's pulled out, they don't run and they don't sink. And it doesn't say here explicitly what the arrow is, but this idea that there's an arrow that we can pull out, and that's the medicine, that's the cure for our suffering, is emphasized in many places in the suttas. Some places the arrow is called craving, and because the craving is why we suffer, and so if we can pull out the piercing of craving, then we'll be free. If your analysis of this poem itself suggests that what the arrow means refers to greed, selfish possessiveness, and having a sense of mine. So greed, possessiveness, and mine. Nowhere in this text does it talk about the not-self teachings, but it does talk about how selfishness is a problem, and part of this release is to let go of selfishness. In speaking, the ideal person doesn't make things up, doesn't follow views, or bind themselves to knowledge. Knowing the many commonplace opinions, they are equanimous thinking. That is what others can hold on to. Free of worldly ties, sages here don't follow any faction in a dispute. Peaceful among those not at peace, equanimous thinking, that's what others can hold on to. They don't hold on to anything. They are not an enemy to any doctrine. Not forming opinions, not closed down, and not desirous. They are sages, wise ones who've laid their burden down. So I love this idea of not being an enemy to any doctrine. So not only they don't hold up some doctrine as being ultimate and better than everyone else's doctrine, but they're also not opposing any of those doctrines. They're not getting involved in the whole discussion of doctrines. They're just finding out how to be at peace and live in the world at peace. Wouldn't that be great if we all learned to do that? So throughout, when I wrote this book, I wrote a general introduction to it, and I discussed some of the themes of the book and introduced it. And then I wrote an introduction for each of the 16 poems, because they're a little bit hard to read or understand for the uninitiated. So I do an introduction that kind of sets it up, so that's a lot easier to read the book. And then I have an epilogue, and the epilogue is... I might say that I contradict myself in the epilogue, maybe. One of the things I talk about is that a little bit more of this kind of scholarly analysis of a text, of the source of a text, and how, yes, many people think it's an early text, but for every reason that people argue it's early, there's a counter argument. And so you can't quite be sure what's really going on in this text. But there's so many reasons why it might be an early text. There's some total of them. I think the weight is so strongly in favor of taking it as an early text. I end the book with... So this is, of course, speculation. We know very little about the genesis of the early Buddhist teachings, including the origin of the Book of Eights. Perhaps this uncertainty is appropriate. The Book of Eights contains inspiring teachings pointing to the possibility of peace when we release all our clinging, including clinging to views about religious teachings. It is a peace that is not dependent on knowing whether or not these teachings represent the earliest teachings of the Buddha. For practitioners, it is a peace that authenticates itself. So those are my introduction to this book. And do you have any questions you'd like to ask about it, or if you want to protest? Or if you'd like to debate? If you have your own religious teachings that you want to champion. Hey, please, yes.
Is that the mic?
Is this being talked about, espoused, whatever, anywhere that you know of or has been? Or I'm just curious where it sits in terms of other teachers or whatever.
Oh, do other teachers teach this? Well, it's a text which is known. I know people like Jack Kornfield loves this text, and when he's been responsible for the teacher training, he usually assigns this to people to read as part of their teacher training. But it's kind of it's a little bit tucked away, and. So it's not so obvious and so easy to find. It's actually, usually it's found in a larger anthology. To get a sense of how obscure it is for some people, unless, maybe I can read this. While the earliest evidence indicates that the Book of Eights was originally an independent work, for at least 1,500 years it has been housed in one of the five sections of an anthology of scriptures called the Sutta Nipata, or Discourse Section. The Sutta Nipata, in turn, is one of 16 texts placed within a larger anthology called the Minor Collection, which is itself one of five collections of texts that make up the Sutta Pitaka, or the Basket of Discourses, which itself is one of three collections that makes up the sacred canon of early Buddhism. So it's kind of like, you know, like Russian dolls or something, you know. And so, you know, it's kind of, so it's not so, you know, it doesn't jump out easily to someone to find. It's kind of tucked away.
Seems very relevant with the recent election.
I'm really looking forward to reading your book. It seems like a lot of of your ideas are very similar to Stephen Batchelor's recent books and his stress on the early context, the early Buddhist writings, and his stress on the teachings of the Buddha. He was a secular teacher. He was a teacher for not for monks necessarily, but for everyone, uh-huh. for the secular uh-huh. community.
I think that's a fair statement to make. I think there's a lot of commonality that I have with Stephen Batchelor's teachings, but often for different reasons, often for based on different evidence and getting there a different way. and, you know, I came up with this title before he came up with the title for his latest book. So this book is called The Buddha Before Buddhism. And his book is called After Buddhism. And he does do an endorsement in the back, so there, you know, so to make the connection is not so strange. Not so, yes.
So, what you said at the beginning about this kind of radical sentence about finding peace without relying on any religious doctrine—have you found that? Having taken 20 years to write this book, that this has actually influenced the way you're teaching, And my second question is, do you feel that because the the text is putting emphasis on non-religious doctrine, that there would be you know, possibility for broader appeal than people that are interested in Buddhism?
So has it influenced me? I think certainly it's inspired me. I mean, some of the ways that I understand this text were understandings that I had before I came to this text, and partly I was inspired or felt supported by some of the directions I was going, and some of it came out of my Zen training, some of it came by my readings, the early Buddhist teachings in general. But certainly it encourages me to keep focusing on our direct experience. And even though I write about Buddhism and teach about Buddhism, the point is always to encourage people to come back into the direct experience and try to find the freedom that's possible here and now. That's very direct. That doesn't really require, you know, a lot of teachings, and certainly doesn't require a PhD in Buddhism. And then the other thing was, the second question was...
The second question was, yes, since the basis of the text is not requiring any agreement to or following doctrines, yeah, would that have, you know, broader appeal, since it seems like, you know, everybody wants to find personal peace?
Right. Well, so the wider appeal, a wider applicability of this... You know, the book explicitly says it's not criticizing or debating other people's doctrines. It's not saying other people are wrong or their doctrines. So in doing that, it kind of separates itself from the contentious world of beliefs and doctrines and who's better, who's higher, who's better. But it does point to a possibility of psychological peace that is attainable by anyone. And so maybe it's a place of, it would be nice if this was a meeting ground for people who have many diverse different points of view. Yes, we can't agree about religious viewpoints, we can't agree about doctrine, but we can at least live together peacefully, we can find peace together. We can have internal peace ourselves, and in that peaceful place we might have an interesting conversation, but we're not going to get worked up and angry or get upset about blasphemy and things like that. So maybe one more, or a couple more. Yeah, go ahead.
For some years, I've found myself wondering to what extent the Majjhima Nikaya and the Digha Nikaya and connected numerical discourses that I'm somewhat familiar with were a constructed, shaped, thought through, systematized in the 400 years after the Buddha's death and before they were finally written down. And not being a scholar enough to have any real opinion on that, but I've wondered, and from a comment you made just earlier, it seems like you think that might have been the case. Can you comment on that? And my second question is, where can we buy the book locally, if it is anywhere? Yeah.
So the collection of sacred texts from early Buddhism is voluminous. It's like, you know, it's one count, there is 18,000 discourses attributed to the Buddha. And then, you know, if you get the English translation, they'd probably, you know, be, I don't know, a foot and a half wide on your shelf. There's a lot of, you know, pretty big. And so are all those attributed to the Buddha? Did they come from the Buddha? Were they edited? Were they added? Were they augmented, developed later after the Buddha? This is one of the holy grails of Buddhist studies, try to understand that. And there's a lot of intense work to try to tease apart, try to analyze these texts to see when they were constructed, how, and all that. And so far, no one's really been able to find criteria to really be able to do it in a responsible way. So we're still looking to understand. But one of the things to keep in mind is the Buddha taught for 45 years, which is a very long time. And it's very easy to imagine that something like this could have been the seeds of his teachings. But then as he kept teaching and meeting different people, people came with questions, with challenges, all kinds of things, that so it's turned off in the outer hall. Sometimes it comes on back by itself. And also, you might have heard enough to know to be peaceful now. But maybe, yeah. It's back now? It's back, you see? I just had to make silly statements, and it's back. That, it's coming and going. We're almost over, so I'll try to speak louder. There's a gremlin in the system that kicks in some point, tells me we should go home. So the Holy Grail, so he taught for 45 years, and that's a long time for someone to kind of think about and formulate and systematize the teachings, kind of really get it organized so it could be passed on and transmitted down through the ages. So it's hard to know whether the more developed forms that we have were his doing or what came later. And you know, some other time I've done some intensive research on one topic around this, and so some other time I'll introduce that. So one more, if I, yeah. Where can we buy it? Yeah, I don't know. We just. I think that I was told that Barnes and Noble bought 700 copies because they liked the cover. And so I guess the Barnes and Noble is the store. I don't know what other stores have it. Amazon of course has it, and Barnes and Noble's online has it. Shambhala it's published by Shambhala, has it. Walmart has it online. So you know we've made it. What? East West and Mountain View probably has it. Not yet, yeah. And sorry?
Can we have a bulk order here?
If people want to organize that, that'd be fine with me, but I'm not going to get involved. So, okay, so do you have one? Yeah, go ahead.
I wondered what the relationship is between suffering and peace. Is suffering like a larger aspect to it, and peace is maybe, or the absence of peace, maybe conflict is a precursor to suffering. So does it start to link in that concept? And if they're similar or related, how does that relate to me, when I focus on Buddhism, I do away with most of the additional stuff that was thrown on. And it's really, to me, it is a humanistic psychology. It's dealing with the nature of the suffering and why we suffer, which is the human right. mind. And beyond that, everything else is this sort of extra stuff. And so to me, this doesn't seem very radical. So how...
It's not radical in itself, but it's radical in relationship to what other people do.
Right. So anyway, but so you've got peace, suffering, and then the Four Noble Truths, which is really just deals with it. Is it that radically different from...
From what you're saying, no, probably not. I think that the word dukkha or suffering doesn't appear so much in this text, but it's clearly that's what they're focusing on, is freedom from suffering that comes from craving. And you could easily, find the Four Noble Truths or use the Four Noble Truths as a summary of this kind of text. The Four Noble Truths make sense as a kind of a summary of some of these early teachings that arose. The Four Noble Truths... it's very interesting that they're actually very rare. It's very rare how often the Buddha taught them. They're held up as being his central, most important teachings. But in the whole canon, these 18,000 texts, there's only 5 places where the Buddha actually mentions the Four Noble Truths. And some of those texts are ones that this careful scholarly work of differentiating later and early layers. Some of these are one of the most obvious ones, which are later layers and probably post-date the Buddha. And so the Four Noble Truths disappear as being reliably from the Buddha. What do you think of that?
I'm done.
You're done. Well, you didn't listen then, because because you're not supposed to rely on ultimate truth. So do we have time for one more, or you guys is patient enough? We're all over. Can we think we can do it quickly? I see you've been trying, and I'm torn between the rest of you and you. And
yeah, I guess the pragmatist in me asks the question from what you've read, how do I take this concept, particularly the peacefulness, creating peace in my life and in the world,
right,
to take the larger view? What does that call forth in terms of a daily practice of mindfulness in the world? Like, you know, when I'm talking to someone, when I'm posting on Facebook or whatever else I might be doing, how do I bring this intention to be peaceful,
uh-huh,
into those opportunities, those conversations, and I guess take the sage into the world? And
looking at questions
about how to do that.
Good question. I think you have to want to do it more than anything else. And so you might want to look at your desires, what you want in your life. And if this becomes the thing you want the most, then you'll follow through. But if you have other things you want to do more, if it's more important to post... So it's a good question, and I could say more, but I don't want to... You're a captive audience, and we're over time. So I thank you all very much, and I hope this was interesting for you.